isn't as well recognized as it could be is the fact that a lot of the particularly activist movements among Native people were tended to be urban-based as opposed to reserve-based. My background is basically urban. Even though my reserve is here, I was born and raised most of my time in Detroit, Michigan.
Oh, yeah.
And, oh my God. Born and raised in Detroit, Michigan, and I spent some time, you know, here in the community, and some time, you know, in the urban setting. So, and generally, like the bulk, my education experience is basically U.S. urban. All right. This was more of a, you know, a place to come back to rather than a place to live. I grew up in Michigan because that's where my work was. Or that's where my father's work was. That's where the family work was.
What did your father work as?
Well,
cars?
Yeah. He was, for a while, he was a professional athlete. He was a boxer. But he went to university at that time, which was very unusual, at Wayne State in Detroit. Very unusual thing for him. He almost got deported because, like, he's being a Canadian Indian, you know. When he was going to university, it was around the time of World War II. And he had tried being patriotic, as most Indian people are, tried to enlist through the reserve officer training program, but didn't like, at that time, a lot of black and native non-white officers, and so they refused his application to the program. And so when time came for him to be drafted in the army, he said, "Well, to heck with you guys." And he ended up sitting out the war. And yeah, they almost were going to try to deport him, which would have been really unusual, having Indians deported here and there among North America. It was very difficult to justify.
It's been done.
It's been many done. It's strange, though, because, you know, like, even though he was a member of the Oneida Reserve, he had two Oneida communities that he really qualifies for on basis of American law and blood. So, anyway, so that's most of the time I grew up in the States, in urban. Nothing unusual about my background. I grew up in an area where there was, I really didn't have any contact with a lot of the racism or things that a lot of Native people have faced. I grew up in an area that was basically middle class, upper middle class. My father passed away when I was very young, about 15 or so. And, but, you know, generally it was in an area where there wasn't a lot of contact with Native people. And, I was looked at as more a unique person than a person.
Because you were
than
just
an
one
inferior.
Of your kind.
I was just one of the group, and I grew up with no other imperative other than the imperative everyone else around me had: excel at what you do. And I did very well. I excelled in school. Went on to University of Michigan on a Regents scholarship.
What did you take? Journalism?
Well,
English?
No, English. I'm more interested in the written word. Actually, I was one of these people with a varied background. I had no problem in physics, and I took a lot of physics and math at the university level as well. But I love to read, and I love good literature, and that was my main area of study. But later on, well, I
when
I
did in the '60s.
In the '60s, we later on because of work problems at home. You know, again, like, we were basically...
Sorry, Mr. Is the secretary gone for the day?
She's gone for the week.
For the week. Okay. Are you taking care of things for her?
Hopefully.
Okay.
You know, I had to finally drop out of school, you know, to help support the family. I had actually, by that time, I had two brothers, another sister, and my mother, all going back to university. And I dropped out to help support the family. And I found myself up to my rear end in trouble in Vietnam for about a year and a half in the U.S. Army.
Were you actually drafted?
No.
No,
at that point, when it came to, there was a certain trend, you know, like for non-whites in the U.S. Army ended up in the infantry.
Exactly.
Most infantry companies were 50% black.
Yeah. And an overproportionate number of Indians.
Oh yeah, it was crazy. So
they were the ones that were. Actually, there were reports that North Vietnamese refused to shoot black people, and quite often they were spared, but still they were disproportionately killed.
Disproportionately killed, and certainly disproportionately represented in all the crummy stuff. Well, when
Same
I went,
in the British Army today.
Yeah. So when I went, and I enlisted, and I managed to have a relatively uneventful army experience. I always worked generally either in an adjutant general's office or special detachments. I wasn't walking the point with any people shooting at me. But after getting out, I became more interested, particularly in the Native issues, because it had come back home to me, you know.
When would that be, in the late 60s?
Well,
early 70s?
I got out of the Army in 1970.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. So it would have been in the early 70s. Right around 1970. And I just started becoming a little bit more involved than I had in the past. Working more closely with our Longhouse people here in Oneida. In
connection. Is there a Longhouse on the Oneida Reserve?
Yeah.
Has always been?
Yeah. Always has been.
Mm-hmm.
A few years they had to black out the windows back in, well, that was during my lifetime, 40s and 50s. They had to black out the windows so that the local ministers wouldn't lead raids on the Longhouse.
Did they do that?
Certainly.
What church?
Anyone that knew that we were having ceremonies at the time, it was a fairly regular occurrence. You know?
Is there a law in Canada to protect Native religion?
Is there a law?
Like the American Indian Religious Freedom Act of 1978 in the U.S.
I don't know if anything
passed
like that is that specific.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure something along the order of the... either the Charter of Rights or the new Constitution, or the recognition of Aboriginal and treaty rights, and the new Constitution would more than cover that off. At that time, though, that was a time of big assimilation.
You know?
People in my age group even were very much discouraged to the point of punishment in schools for speaking Native languages. And things of that nature.
We put out a book, interviews like this kind, which we transcribe, and one of the largest section is on the schooling of Native Americans. We have two parts, education and schooling.
Yeah.
And so I'm interested in that kind of stuff, because I think people in Europe in particular, but white people here too, should know the good Christians, what they donate their money for, you know, and the destruction of other cultures.
Yeah. Well, most of that is, hopefully we've seen the last of it.
Hopefully.
Yeah, I know that right here, we, you know, even at the university, there's a very much encouragement to the preservation and promotion of native languages. And there's a couple of members of our Senate students here working in connection with King's College that are working on developing additional language materials and things. So I think that trend, the trend towards assimilation, I think it's obviously been shown not to work. And I think hopefully, at least for this generation and the next couple, that that thought will keep out of other people's minds. Because obviously it didn't work. And no matter what was done, despite...
I think it'll never work.
It'll never work. And it'll continue no matter how strict it gets. It's much more likely to die from inactivity or disinterest on a part of Native people than it is from any sort of encouragement from the non-Indian population.
Are you scared of that?
No.
So why are you saying that?
No, I just think it's just more likely. I think if the governments were tried, you know, to a policy of assimilation, everyone would just get their back
up. Get out,
and it would be that they might be that much more determined to prevent it.
So, how did you get started?
How did I get started?
Native movement.
Gee, you know, I don't know, just interest, involvement. I know it had always been an informal basis, you know, like I always, you know, volunteered, helped out, pitched in with things that were happening. When I met my wife, they put it out of more at Akwesasne Notes. It was a more of a mercenary sort of basis. I know that, some of the political organizations before, you know, had asked me to come to work for them. I'd never really found the inclination, you know, to do it because I felt it tied me down quite a bit. It limited what I could do. You know, to take a job, an actual job, working for natives, is more of a limiting factor than it, provides you additional avenues. Of course, I found that marriage tied me down just as much as any job would, and so I really became involved in some of the other organizations outside of things like the American Indian Movement and things like that after I got married and I settled down myself. Originally, I started off in Toronto working for the Union of Ontario Indians.
The one that put out the Ontario Indian.
Started as a development officer. I was more or less charged with trying to coordinate programs and environmental issues, health, education, economic development, social services, housing, capital and public works. I was the one that was supposed to try to unify the policy and try to give it a direction based upon what the chiefs were saying that they wanted. All right, so we didn't have people working at cross purposes. And the idea was to try to put some principles behind the work that we were doing. Like what was our goals?
Yeah.
What were our values as a people? And to try to put that to voice and have that understanding among the staff members and among the members of the Union of Ontario Indians. I think to a limited extent that was fairly successful. At least we got some straight statements as to what our values were, which were self-determination, self-government, economic non-dependence, social responsibility, and cultural preservation.
Yeah.
In no particular order, but those values had to underlie all the work that we did.
Yeah.
As a political organization or as officers with special program delivery responsibilities.
Have any of those values or goals changed since then?
No. It's been very consistent. I don't think it wasn't so much that I had anything to do with promoting them. It was more or less trying to crystallizing them out of what people have been saying for many, many years. And from that, we developed the work plan that a lot of the organizations have looked at, you know, like not in terms of necessarily political independence, but at least to maximize our self-determination as part of a number of peoples that exist now in North America. Some of the things that we looked at is we were looking at trying to develop programs in all of these areas that were reflective of Indian culture, Indian values, things that were operated in the Indian communities rather than depending on going to town to get this or going to town to get that service. Programs that were determined by Indians, community-based and community-planned.
So did you go into education a lot?
A bit. Actually, I had to work in all of those areas. Generally, you know, we did have workers specific to that area, but I had to be aware of all of those things. But eventually, after several years there, I was asked to go and administrate the National Indian Brotherhood as the executive director up there. And
where are they located?
That was in Ottawa.
And actually,
I was there when we sort of underwent a change, and we instead of the National Indian Brotherhood, which at that time was an organization made up of provincial level organizations. During the time I was there, we metamorphosed into what is now the Assembly of First Nations, which again brought it down the representation to a community level, as opposed to a political organization board. It became a national organization of chiefs representing their individual communities.
Would that be status Indians only or non-status Indians?
It was all status Indians.
All status?
All status Indians. They were all represented by Indian bands, of which there were about 530-some in Canada now. After that, I then went back to the Union of Ontario Indians, resumed my duties, making sure everything was fine, and the program planning end of things. And eventually, I came back to my home area, which is London, as a director of the Friendship Center here in London, which, again...
What does the Friendship Center do?
It's got a couple of functions. One is social service delivery. Many of many Native people still find difficulties adjusting to the urban life, and it's providing those adjustments, directing people to the proper agency, and providing a community focus for cultural Native activities. After a couple of years there, I decided to work.
I wonder if I left Bruce.
That's basically what I did, come back to my local area, work with the Friendship Center as executive director there. Just immediately before I started this.
How long were you at the Friendship?
I was there about a year and a half. Very different thing for me. Up until then, I've been working.
Social work and a lot of
social work, a lot of administration. It was not difficult. I found it much more difficult in the other because I was continually dealing and negotiating with provincial and federal level politicians all the time, and a lot of the work involved analytical work of provincial, federal legislation, consultation work with the chiefs, making sure they had a basis for making informed decisions on issues that came up. To me, that's a very difficult thing to do because you have to sort of have an understanding of what their priorities are before you can even do that. So I found the work at the local level. Actually, it was rather easy, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was rather...
Because you could see what you accomplished.
You could see your accomplishments there. But and it wasn't so taxing, you know. Mm-hmm. If a person's there and a person's hungry, you find a way to get them food,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, I found that, you know, fairly satisfying. But in a sense, you know, this opportunity here attracted me because I have the sense that that working Indian journalists can provide Native communities with more opportunities for political development, because I think I think in many cases, you know, as Native people, we really haven't looked at ourselves as hard as we could.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like our communities aren't as demanding of our political leaders as we could, or perhaps
mm-hmm.
we should be.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's important to political
mm-hmm.
growth,
mm-hmm.
Political maturity. And
that's
one thing we lack.
Is that so? Is that coming out of tradition, or is it part of mental colonization? So that very often it seems as if the communities put up with some of the leaders that may be mediocre or even rip off the people on the
administration. I don't think it's a part of tradition. I think it's a part of apathy and a sort of a division, a sense of division, an apartness between the system and the living day to day, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like most, a lot of our Native communities, the sort of political system we have now has no bearing or relationship to our traditional
right.
political
system. Do you find that on many communities you have basically two structures?
No.
A traditional one and then a modern
no.
political one?
No.
No.
It's basically true on most Six Nations reserves,
mm-hmm.
right? But many of the other communities have almost divorced themselves of the older traditional systems.
So they've deliberately or enforceably given up the old structure? Maybe that's too simplistic a question.
Yeah, I think it is. It's a lot more
mm-hmm.
complicated than that. It's
mm-hmm.
a combination of a whole lot of things. Religious training, experience,
mm-hmm.
past experience with government.
What is the in your experience, the greatest agents to cut off the traditions or to de-Indianize? What have been the most effective tools of the dominant society to de-Indianize?
Economics.
Uh-huh.
That's it, plain and simple.
Economic deprivation.
Economic deprivation. I know in our community,
mm-hmm.
when we first had our elective system of government, it came in after we came here. We came here was still our traditional government's intact.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very long process to get any elective system in, because at Oneida, no one wanted to participate. My understanding
mm-hmm.
of the story
mm-hmm.
is that they had an election. Do you want to have an elected system?
Yeah.
The final vote, the first one was 3-0 or something like that, because only people participated in the election.
Yeah.
I think they had to run that through that two or three times as a matter of form before they declared that those three or four people indeed, you know, constituted
majority
opinion.
Yeah, that seems to be the pattern, or seems to have been the pattern on many reserves and reservations
yeah.
south of the 49th.
Yeah. So, you know, it's still a relatively new system to us, but I don't, you know, that's the way it came in. There's
mm-hmm.
there's certainly still a sense of divorcement from that. But because, you know, like the religious problems and all
yeah.
these other things, you know, like it's gradually gained, you know, reasonable acceptance, you know, in the community.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably got generally more community support than the traditional system.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they don't like the way the traditional system is run either.
Mm-hmm.
But generally the upshot of what happened when an elective system is brought in as the recognized government
mm-hmm.
by the federal government of Canada or whoever.
The colonizing forces.
The colonizing forces, all, you know, that mm-hmm. those are the agents, again, of the money that comes from the,
yeah.
the colonizers.
So it's primarily economic.
It's economic trends. You know, like, there is where the services and goods are. Why would this people,
sounds like a Marxist
those are the people
view.
You go through.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I thought there was a sequence. Economics first, and together with that, the military, and then the schools, and then the missionaries and the schools.
Yeah.
And now it's people interested in Indian spirituality, white people interested in that, trying to reach for the essence. That's what a lot of Native friends I've talked to say. I mean, they've taken everything, and now they...
Yeah. To me, it breaks down to even today, it's still a very much an economic situation.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
When you look at, even politically, what the Native people are asking for
mm-hmm.
in terms of constitutional recognition and those types of things. A lot of those things, over time,
mm-hmm.
there has been a certain understanding, it seems, among the Native people that the future requires a secure economic system.
Yeah.
And in many cases, you find that what we're negotiating for at a lot of constitutional tables and things of that
mm-hmm.
nature is not the preservation of our cultural values, but a piece of the economic pie.
Yeah.
And I guess it's all part of things. So.
Mm-hmm. How can journalism help?
Well, I think we lack a lot of political development. I don't think we have. I think there's a dearth of leadership in Native communities.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a reflection of the type of system that we operate now.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter. I mean, at least in most traditional systems, whether they were hereditary or chosen on a clan basis or whatever,
mm-hmm.
our leaders had to show wisdom,
sure.
courage.
Integrity
over time.
Mm-hmm.
Now those requirements just don't exist in the elective system.
No.
The
sure.
requirement is that you get more votes than the other
exactly.
guy.
Exactly.
And that's
mm-hmm.
and that's enough.
Yeah.
And I, as a result,
but
I think.
I see media as the agent. Who
I see
could
as a
look
media as an internal critical agent.
As a sort of if they take an ethic or a moral stand, right?
Yeah.
But
and
the media are corruptible too.
Media are corruptible, but you know, that's a tool that you can use. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Sure, the tool can be corrupted. But
to keep the leaders straight.
To keep the leaders straight, to look at, make certain that they're reflecting
yeah.
what the real wants and needs are in the community. And right now, it's a role that most Native community newspapers tend to be house organs of the politics that
mm-hmm.
are currently in
yeah,
power.
Because that's where they get the money.
And generally the mainstream media will go out of their way
mm-hmm.
To avoid
mm-hmm.
conflict.
Yeah.
In some senses, our media, our mainstream media in Canada is... is very concerned about their approach to Native people, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's difficult even at times to find constructive criticism
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In the Native media, in the mainstream
the national,
media.
Mm-hmm.
They'll go overboard to avoid
mm-hmm.
even the appearance of the least, you know, criticism
yeah, yeah.
of what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
In the community. It's very much to gone flat back the other way,
mm-hmm.
and in a sense that's good because I think that those types of things that when we talk about local political development that has to come from the people of the community,
yeah.
And I think they're more likely to hear that or listen to it or pay attention to it
mm-hmm.
from other Native people that they know,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to
definitely,
an outside force
definitely.
Providing.
Yes.
What they would look at it,
mm-hmm.
a jaundiced view. I know me you know, from a background of a journalist, you know, I could criticize my band and my government and what they're doing for our people. Mm-hmm. But the minute the London Free Press does,
sure,
it gets my back up.
Sure.
Uh-huh. And I think that's crucial to Native political development.
Yeah.
The ability to just look at yourself for what you are and what you're doing. Mm-hmm. And hopefully that's the kind of role some of our students have played and will continue to play when they get out and work.
Mm-hmm. I've got to look at this because I'm going to meet Robin down in the, what is it, Graduate Lounge or something?
Grad Lounge down, two floors down?
At 4:30 she finishes teaching and she'll be open. So I'm supposed to go, which is bad. I'm leaving London tomorrow lunchtime, to go on to Peterborough. They got a Native Studies program there. Mm-hmm. Do you know anybody?
At Trent? Mm. Oh, I don't know. Don McCaskill's still up there.
Yeah, he's still up there. Uh-huh. Yeah. Is he Native?
I don't know. Oh. Doubt it. I don't know.
That was... Sorry, maybe I've got a stereotype, but that was a typical answer. Yeah. If you don't want to answer something, or maybe think it's not a good answer, so I don't know.
I don't know. I know that there's...
And
there does seem to be a lack... Well, I know there's some really good Native people up there, but I know. I'm the first... I should talk. I'm the first Native person they've ever had in this position here.
Mm-hmm. Did I tell you I went to the Saskatchewan Federated Indian College and they just started an English department there, and the head of